Thank you very much, Jean-François, for the invitation to speak here and for the kind introduction. So I will talk about inference method to help determine stress fields in epithelial monolayers. And I would like to start by thanking my collaborators on this topic. So the practical implementation of the method I'm going to describe has been done by Vincent Nier during his PhD. This work is part of a long-standing collaboration with colleagues in Japan, in particular Shuji Ishihara at the University of Tokyo. The validation of the method has been done on experiments supervised by Benoît Ladoux and René-Marc Meige, and performed by Grégoire Perret and Shreyansh Jain during their PhD. And I've also been collaborating with colleagues in Lyon, in Heidelberg, and in Australia. In fact, historically, starting being interested in the determination of forces in tissues following a set of discussions organized by François Graner at Paris Diderot, at Université de Paris, with Cyprien Gay and Chant Lilly. And probably we started around 2012 or 13. And in fact, in 2014, if I'm not wrong, François Graner and others, namely Pierre-François Lenne and Kaoru Sugimura, organized a workshop whose purpose was to review the state of the art concerning measuring forces and stresses in living tissues. So I've just been patching together the figures from this review paper, which I very much recommend. And as you can see or guess, there is a lot of diversity in the method used. Some using contact with the tissue by pushing or by micropipette aspiration here. Some are molecular, using FRET, for instance. Some work at the tissue scale, like, for instance, ablation here. Some use light in order to exert forces and deflect elements of the tissue in order to estimate forces, or light and, for instance, birefringence in order to evaluate anisotropic stresses in tissues. So, of course, I do not have time to discuss all this in detail, but as an introduction, I selected three examples of these methods, which, were used by each of the three authors of this paper, and I think give a good introduction to what will follow. So the first one is cell junction ablation, and in fact, I think Johannes, a couple of weeks ago, mentioned this already. So what you see here is the apical surface of Drosophila germen, so a part of the Drosophila embryo. The idea is to use sufficiently strong laser light in order to ablate, to destroy one of the cell junctions. The process is obviously highly invasive. What typically happens is that the junction is ablated and the two connected vertices retract. So in terms of mechanics, the interpretation is fairly straightforward, as you can see on this figure. This is the one of the closest three cellular junctions to the ablated junction. Typically, one can assume that mechanical equilibrium is respected before the ablation, which means that the three tensions cancel. When, for instance, this junction is ablated, the force F1 goes to zero, the vertex starts to move, and the initial velocity, which goes against the direction of the original tension, gives an indication of the value of the force F1, given that we expect a friction force opposite to the velocity V to intervene in the dynamics of this vertex. So to sum things up, a measurement of the initial recoil velocity of the vertex gives an assessment of the value of the tension of the junction that has been ablated up to a friction coefficient. And in this particular case, the relaxation times were of the order of 50 seconds, initial velocity of the order of 0.1 to 0.01 micrometer per second. And this tool was used to show that, in fact, in the jargon of the Drosophila, cell junction tensions were highly isotropic, which helped explain the anisotropy of T1 transition that led to elongation of the germ band. So if you are interested not in local forces, but in tissue scale forces, it is of course possible, but labor intensive, to repeat the same process on a large number of junctions and to perform averages in order to access the tissue scale stress. One drawback of the method is that it is relative in the sense that typically the friction coefficients are not known, and that the quantity which is measured is not a force, but a velocity. So it's actually useful in order to make comparisons between tensions at different points of a tissue, but cannot be used for absolute measurement. With François Graner, and in collaboration also with Isabelle Bonnet, who performed the experiment, we scaled up this method and practiced tissue scale ablations of the tissue. So instead of ablating one junction, Isabelle ablated a whole ring and followed the retraction of the two pieces of the tissue that had been separated by the ablation. The tissue here is in fact the same that appeared on the last slide presented by Jean-François. We are on the notum of the pupal Drosophila, close to the midline, and the difference in the width of the open domain indicates that tension in the tissue is anisotropic. And in fact, so here the representation is a bit different from what is standard in the field. The midline is along the y-axis, whereas this corresponds to the mediolateral axis. So in this particular case, we have a larger stress across the midline compared to the stress along the midline. So in order to analyze the data, we focused on the central part of the tissue, fitted this central part by an ellipse of semi-axis X and Y. And again, a stress can be estimated from the behavior of the tissue right after the ablation. It's easy to show that the ratio of stress to tissue viscosity is given by the ratio of the initial velocity by the initial position of the tissue. What you see on this graph is that the anisotropy that is observed here is in fact not a given of the tissue. It develops a long time. And here the comparison between experiments done for young, middle-aged, and old age groups corresponds to times after pupa formation between, roughly speaking, 15 hours and 16 hours. So this is much more interesting in order to assess the stress properties at the scale of the tissue. The drawback is the same as previously, in the sense that what is measured is not directly a force or a stress, it's a kinematic quantity, a velocity, and what we obtain is the ratio of stress over viscosity. And again, assuming that this dissipative coefficient does not depend on space or time, we obtain a relative measurement that allows to perform comparisons between the tissue at different times or between the stress conditions at different places in the tissue. The next example comes from my collaborators Shuji Ishihara and Kaoru Sugimura in Tokyo and Kyoto, respectively. The idea here is to, in fact, consider the apical surface of the tissue in the light of the cell vertex model and to write at each vertex in the tissue a force balance equation involving the tensions on each of the junctions of this tricellular junction, plus the pressures. And to hopefully solve for tensions and pressures, the large system of coupled linear equations that results from this approach. So indeed, this is a bit unusual. The author made the approximation that the curvature was small enough so that these expressions were correct. Of course, this can be generalized to different conditions. And here, the assumption is obviously not so bad from the image. One issue when you look at the system of equations is that we have less equations than unknowns. The system is underdetermined, which means that it cannot be inverted straightforwardly. They used statistical methods based on inversion in order to circumvent this problem and managed to obtain, so from images of, I think, the wing here, yes, a map of tensions and a map of pressures, which allows to reconstruct the stress of each cell, and given the stress of each cell to coarse grain and to obtain the stress of the tissue, which is represented here. Just as Jean-François explained a moment ago. However, you may have noticed that we started from images, not from force measurements, which means that, again, we cannot obtain absolute values of the stresses with this method. In fact, here only differences of pressures are measured, and the tension has no unit. It is obtained up to, a constant arbitrary value, which may be simply the mean of the tensions over the tissue. So this points to the need of using force measurements in order to be able to determine the absolute values of the stress field within a tissue. Now, there is a very popular and today very common method in order to measure forces in epithelial monolayers. But the forces that are measured are external forces. They are the so-called traction forces that are exerted by the tissue on the substrate. The idea is to culture the monolayer on a soft substrate. In fact, a substrate sufficiently soft to be deformed by the activity of the cell. What is measured are the displacements of beads into the substrate, which I call U here. The substrate is a simple elastic solid, which means that the forces and the displacement can be related through the equations of elasticity for the substrate. So this amounts to obtaining traction forces from displacement, which means that here again, we need to invert a linear system. Here, the matrix is square, an a priori invertible, but it is badly conditioned, which explains that people have had to resort to regularization procedures in order not to amplify the noise, in fact, when performing the inversion. And a standard way to do this is to introduce a regularization parameter that will allow to include as a weight in the calculation the norm of the traction forces, and therefore to avoid unphysically large values of the traction force when performing the inversion. So if we have data for these traction forces, the traction forces are related to the internal stresses of the tissue through force balance, which is here. So the divergence of the stress field that we are looking for is equal to the traction force vectors. And what we would like to do is to invert this equation. Now, immediately, there is a problem. The data is a vector field, so we have two components per spatial or spatial-temporal point, whereas the stress field is a tensor, in practice a symmetric tensor, which means that we have three components per point in space or in time, which means that discretizing this equation, the resulting system of coupled linear equations is not square. We have to invert a large rectangular matrix, which of course is not possible. So there is one particular case where integration or inversion is easy. It's the case where the system is one-dimensional or quasi-one-dimensional. And this will be the case, for instance, when a tissue expands into free space with approximate statistical invariance along the axis perpendicular to the direction of spreading. So in that case, we can define 1D quantities in the direction of spreading by averaging over the other direction. The problem becomes 1D. This equation reduces to divergence of one-dimensional stress equals component of the traction force along x, and it's very easy to integrate the traction forces, the average traction forces along x, to obtain a profile of tension which typically increases as we go farther from the free boundary. When the system is 2D, this trick does not work. And so some people have added additional information on the mechanics of the tissue in order to make the problem invertible. And in practice, Trepa and collaborator have assumed a linear isotropic elastic rheology for the tissue. In that case, the tissue stress is related to the tissue strain by this type of equation from elasticity, which involves elastic moduli and Poisson ratio, and allow to relate stress to a vector field, which is the vector field of displacement in the tissue, which explains why the equations become invertible. One drawback is that this is an additional hypothesis. It is not clear at all that all tissues are elastic at all times and in all conditions. And in particular, since an assumption is made on the rheology, the method cannot be used in order to study the rheology using the obtained stress. For this reason, we decided to use a Bayesian method in order to obtain the stress field from the traction force field. So this is simply giving you the discretized version of the partial differential equation that relates traction force to stress. A is the matrix that we would like to invert. We will not try to add more equations in order to make this matrix square. We will completely change approach and use a probabilistic perspective in order to solve the equation and use Bayes' formula in order to determine the most likely value of the stress tensor field in the tissue given the traction force data. So the Bayes' formula involves two ingredients. One is called the likelihood function, which is given you the which is giving you the distribution function of traction force given stress, and a prior function which embodies the additional knowledge that we may possess on the unknown on the stress field. What we have shown is that using Gaussian distribution functions for both likelihood and prior allowed us to obtain a reliable estimate of the stress as the mode, the most likely value of the posterior density function. When this Gaussian statistical hypothesis is made, we can in fact compute analytically the estimated stress as a function of the traction force data, using A, the discretized version, the matrix that discretizes the divergence operator, and the covariance matrices of the likelihood S and of the prior S0. We have tested the method on numerical data using numerical simulation of a viscous material driven by active force dipoles. So what you see on the right is a typical snapshot of the force vectors in 2D of this simulation. What you see on the left is a typical snapshot of the stress. Red corresponds to compression, blue corresponds to tension locally in the tissue. And we have represented at each point the principal axis of the stress tensor. What you see here in the bottom is the inferred stress by Bayesian inversion, which is, well, qualitatively very similar to the exact numerical values. And indeed, the determination coefficient is typically larger than 0.9 or 0.95, as evidenced by this graph where we plot inferred stress versus numerical values of the stress. In practice, the method depends on just one parameter, which I call lambda, and which I call a regularization parameter, by reference with the regularization parameter that is used in traction force microscopy. It is dimensionless, and it is related to so the grid mesh, the variance of the likelihood, and the variance of the prior. And the nice thing is that this coefficient can be determined self-consistently from the data itself. So there is no additional hypothesis on this quantity. And we have used two different methods which gave consistent results in order to determine a value of lambda, typically of the order of 10 to the minus 6, which is not zero. We need regularization, but still is small, which means that most of the information that we use in order to obtain the inferred stress comes from the data and not from the prior. In fact, we have also checked that assumptions made on the prior were not crucial in obtaining the right inferred stress. And the reason why this is so is that the typical value of regularization parameter is small. So briefly, the first method, which is also commonly used in order to determine the regularization parameter for traction force microscopy, is the L-curve method. This is a parametric plot as a function of lambda of the norm of the prior versus the residual norm, which is the error that we make in the estimation of the stress. For small values of lambda, regularization is weak, which means that the prior norm is going to become large. For very large values of lambda, we make a larger mistake in the estimation of the stress, which is also not very good. The optimal point is intermediate between these two extreme cases and is typically found at this corner of the curve, which has, roughly speaking, the shape of a L, hence the name of the method, the L-curve. Another way of doing things, which maybe is better tuned to Bayesian analysis, is to use what is called maximum a posteriori optimization, which consists in optimizing the a posteriori distribution function with respect to the parameter that we need, namely S and S0. So the optimization is not analytical. We used an iteration implementation of it. And what you can see here is that after a few steps of the implementation, we find a good convergence towards a fixed value of lambda, which coincides with the position of the corner here in the L-curve. We also validated the method experimentally in a quasi-1D system. So this is a cell monolayer of epithelial cells, MDCK cells, in a ring. And the system is quasi-1D since the width of the ring is small compared to the perimeter. In fact, a nice feature of this system is that it leads to collective migration and oscillations of the epithelial monolayer along the ring, but I'm not going to go into this. What you see here on the right is a typical snapshot of the azimuthal component of the traction force field, and here a typical snapshot of the azimuthal component of the inferred stress. The reason I describe this as a validation method is that we can play both ways with this data. One is to consider the system as 2D and obtain indeed a 2D stress field as here, and then average the theta component of the stress across the width to obtain the 1D version. The other is to use the integration of the mechanical balance in order to obtain directly the value of the stress from integration of the average of T theta across the width. What you see on this graph is that the agreement between the two is excellent, which further validates the method, the Bayesian inversion method, from experimental data. Another check is that we do indeed obtain absolute values of the inferred stresses. In fact, in the case like this one, where the tissue is confined, we have stress-free boundary conditions along the boundaries of the tissue. Using these stress-free boundary conditions, it is easy to show by integration by part of the force balance equation that the spatial averages of stresses, of stress components, can be computed exactly by using moments of the corresponding components of the traction force field. So in the case of the pressure, the equation is this one, where we expect the average pressure over space to be equal to 1/2 the first moment of the R component of the traction force data. And we did check indeed that inferred stress values agreed very well with the expected values computed directly from the traction force field. So to summarize this part on the method, we introduced Bayesian inversion stress microscopy, validated the stress estimate with numerical data, validated also the method with experimental data. I did not go into details, but we checked that the method was robust to variation of the statistical assumptions, and we, using numerical simulation, also varied assumptions on the monolayer rheology to confirm robustness with respect to the rheology. And I emphasize that we made no hypothesis on the tissue rheology in order to obtain this absolute measurement of the stress field. Then, of course, we started using the method. And here I'm going to show you some experiment done by Grégoire Perret during his PhD, this time in square domains. So these cells are the same as the one used for the experiment in the ring. And this is the movie of tensions that we typically obtain from Bayesian inference using the traction force data from this experiment, with some heterogeneity, which is perhaps important to notice, is that like in all systems that I've been mentioning so far, the tension is positive and the pressure is negative. And now if we change cell types and switch to ACAT cells, human keratinocytes, we see in a way a lot more activity, and we see coherent oscillations appearing in the system and a global motion of rotation. And this is a typical corresponding movie of the tension field in space and time, with obviously much larger values of the tension that, well, agrees qualitatively with the increased activity that we see above. And again, fairly large inhomogeneities in space. So of course, we can be qualitative and give values of mean tensions, mean shear stresses. So as I said, tension is much larger in ACAT than in MDCK cells. In both cases, shear stresses are close to zero. And we can start to think about using these stress measurements in order to investigate the rheology of the tissue. So what was measured in parallel with traction forces is what I called here a cell-shaped Bayes pneumatic tensor field Q, which is nothing but the elongation tensor that Jean-François discussed before. And what you see on these two graphs are a representation of the anisotropic stress components as a function of the corresponding component of Q. For the two components of these two tensors, and we find a correlation of the order of 0.6. So there is still a lot of noise, but the correlation is, pretty good. And what I would like to emphasize is that the slopes that we can extract from these plots are consistent, which means that the analysis makes sense in a tensor sense. Then, of course, we can do the same for the two cell types. And what we find is that what I call the active modulus, which is nothing but the slope of these linear fits, is much larger for ACAT cells compared to what we find for MDCK cells. Now I would like to come back a little bit to epithelial spreading experiment. And this work has been done in collaboration with Ada Cavalcanti in Heidelberg. So the cell type is different. We here are using carcinoma cells, not epithelial cells. And this is a good example of the quasi-1D system that I mentioned at the very beginning. So there is spreading of this cell layer in the direction X a long time. And, in fact, very good invariance of the properties of the system along Y. So since this is a quasi-1D system, again, I was tempted to use it as a way to further validate the method. One reason being that so far I have been presenting inferences in cases where cells were confined and where we knew what the boundary conditions were. Here I'm going to use the same algorithm with stress-free boundary conditions on the boundaries of this box. And these boundary conditions are just plain wrong, because the stress-free boundary condition should be used here at the free boundary, not over there, and should not be used here because this is just a subset of a much larger tissue. So there is no reason why we should have stress-free boundary conditions at this artificial boundary, which is just defined by the field of view of the microscope. What you can see here is that avoiding cells which are too close to these boundaries, the inference method is pretty robust and still works quite well. Indeed, I am comparing here to the exact 1D tension, which is obtained by integration from the free boundary towards the bulk of the tissue of the X component of the stress. The corresponding quantity obtained by Bayesian inversion in 2D, averaging again against Y. And as you can see, we have very good agreement between the two, which shows that the method is robust also against variations of the boundary conditions. Now, of course, the reason why we studied the system was not just to validate, but was to measure stresses, and in particular to measure tension with respect to variations of the properties of the tissue. Here I need to go a little bit into the details of adherence junctions, which are the adhesive structures that are responsible for part of the mechanical cohesiveness of tissues. So one simplified picture of these adherence junctions is that you have adhesive proteins, eicadherins in the case of epithelial tissues, that are linked to beta-catenin, that are linked to alpha-catenin, that are linked to the actin cytoskeleton in the cortex of the cell. Here, the goal of this work was to provide a control on the presence of this link between the adhesive apparatus and the cytoskeleton of the cells using chemical methods and, in fact, optochemical stimulation of the tissue. So the starting point of the experiment is to use cells where the formation of the adherence junction has been impaired because the cells have been genetically modified so that neither cadherin nor alpha-catenin can bind, as they usually do, to beta-catenin. A compound is added to the cells that will bind both to alpha-catenin and to eicadherin. This compound is a dimer, which is photocleavable, which means that shining UV light on the system is going to cut the junctions again. So one example of this is shown for not for a tissue, but for an aggregate of cell on this movie. In red, on the left side, alpha-catenin is tagged. In green, on the right side, eicadherin is tagged. What you see at the beginning is that adherence junctions are slowly forming and become straight and well-defined after a few hours thanks to this chemical compound. Then at zero, UV light is shown on the system, which breaks the adherence junction. And you see the adhesion lost and the cells moving apart. So we have analyzed epithelial spreading with this system. And what you see here is a series of snapshots, a long time, of so the phase contrast image of the monolayer, the patterns, the special patterns of the traction force norm, the special patterns of the tissue tension, and finally the 1D profile of the tension in the monolayer. On the left, before photocleavage, and on the right, after photocleavage. So one thing which is quite apparent is that there are many cell extrusions after photocleavage, which maybe is not a big surprise as cell-cell cohesion is impaired. And what is clear as well is that traction forces and tensions had been building up until UV light is shown on the system and then decreases. Okay. Which also makes sense as the establishment of tension in the system is a collective effect that requires transmission of forces from cell to cells across adherence junctions. So another way to obtain the same kind of effect is to knock down alpha-catenin in the cells that constitute the cell monolayers. So on the left is the wild-type case that you already saw. So I think it's the same movie. One difference is that cell trajectories here are labeled and describe nice circles to exemplify the collective motion in this system. And this is the tension movie that goes with it, where you can also recognize the collective rotation. In the absence of alpha-catenin, the tissue cohesion is lost. So again, the number of cell extrusions increases, and the circular trajectories are also lost. Now, if I move to tensions, we find a reduction by a factor of, I think, 3 or 4 in the average value of the tension in the monolayer. So I just mentioned extrusions. In a different set experiments with different collaborators, we studied the biomechanics of cell extrusions. So this is one cell leaving the monolayer with the nucleus in blue and the actin cytoskeleton in green. And again, we have here an MDCK cell monolayer, this time confined in a disk. And the extrusions, as always, correspond to the white spots, which appear from time to time in an apparently stochastic fashion on this movie. In this set of experiments, we measured the velocity field, which you could see here on the right-hand side of the movie, the Q tensor, for which a representation is given here on this graph, and the traction forces from which we inferred stresses using Bayesian inversion. The main observation was that the topology of the Q tensor was correlated with the presence of cell extrusions in the monolayer. Here you can notice that the pattern of the principal direction of the nematic tensor is not arbitrary, but in fact correspond to a plus 1/2 defect, which Pascal told us about last week. And indeed, the extrusion is localized close to the head of this plus 1/2 defect. What was observed is that, somewhat unexpectedly, this correlation with plus 1/2 defect is specific. And in particular, for this cell type at least, there is no correlation between the location of extrusions and the location of the other kind of defect that is possible in this system, that is minus 1/2 defects. Now, if we look at the tension field, the blue color corresponds to negative values, and we see that there is here is a domain of negative tension, so positive pressure, in the vicinity of the extrusion. So in fact, we have correlation not only between the topology of the nematic field and the extrusion, but also between the stress field, the behavior of the stress field in the system, and the presence of the extrusion. So I will not get into detail, but give you the gist of this story. Our conclusion from many experiments and many converging observations is that in these cell monolayers, plus 1/2 and minus 1/2 defects of the elongation field are continuously generated as pairs. Close to the plus 1/2 defects, regions of large pressure occur, which act on cells to trigger the process of cell apoptosis and of cell extrusion. And indeed, we have confirmed that the caspase signaling pathway was activated during extrusion, confirming the fact that these extruded cells in the end become dead cells. Our colleagues at Oxford did a bit of modeling of the system and used an active nematic model in order to try to make sense of this situation. They used parameter values for which the active stress is in fact dominant in stresses. And they used numerical simulations which allowed to reproduce the observations made in the experiments, both from kinematics and for stresses. So what you see here on the top are experimental data for the average strain rate close to defects on which is superimposed the nematic director. for both y component and xy, so shear strain rate. What you see here is the average velocity field, which goes towards the head of the defect. And what you see here is the tension field, average again, with blue color, so negative tension or positive pressure, close to the defect. The three observations can be reproduced qualitatively by simulations of this active pneumatic model. And what we see here is that one difference between minus one-half defects and plus one-half defect is the absence of a pressure excess close to the defect, which may explain why the correlation is found between extrusions and plus one-half defects and not between extrusion and minus one-half defects. In the last few slides, I would like to say a few things about modeling. Well, one reason is that Jean-François spent a lot of time discussing the cell vertex model. While recently, in collaboration with Japanese colleagues, we have been putting forward a coarse-grained version of the cell vertex energy. So the idea is actually fairly simple, and it allows to build hydrodynamic models of tissues that are based, in a way, on the cell vertex model, and allow, therefore, to include in these hydrodynamic descriptions coarse-grained versions of the parameter of the cell vertex model, including junction tensions. So that was pretty much our motivation. So the starting point is microscopic, in a sense. So the microscopic scale here is the scale of one cell. One cell can be fitted by an ellipse. And the equation of an ellipse is a polynomial in the coordinates. This polynomial can be rewritten as some matrix times the distance between a point on the ellipse and the center of the ellipse equal to 1. So this form of the equation of the ellipse allows to describe a cell scale, a microscopic cell-shaped tensor, which I call MI, where I is the index for each cell. Now, in order to coarse-grain the problem, the idea is to choose a domain which is large enough to contain a large enough number of cells, but small enough so that the properties within this domain are going to be roughly homogeneous, and to average the cell-shaped tensor over this domain. Okay? And this allows to construct a tissue scale, so a macroscopic cell-shaped tensor, which I call M. The anisotropic part of this tensor is, in fact, similar to the elongation tensor that we discussed before. I say similar and not equal because the dimensions are not the same. So the Q that I had been using before is dimensionless, whereas M has dimension of square length due to its definition here. What we do is start from the energy function of the cell vertex model with an elastic modulus, with a line tension, and an elastic component related to the perimeter, and coarse grain, replacing so the perimeter of one cell by a coarse grain version, and the area of each cell by a coarse-grained version. How do we do this? In fact, the area of the cell and the perimeter of the cell can be computed exactly using the M tensor. So it's straightforward with the area, which is pi AB, where A and B would be the semi-axis of the ellipse. Things are a bit more complicated for the perimeter, but the perimeter can be expressed as a function of parameters of the ellipse using, for instance, a formula due to Euler that we use here in order to write the perimeter as a function of the cell-shaped tensor. In practice, we perform calculation in a simple case where we are close to isotropy, which could be generalized, but which is probably good enough for the models, for the examples that we had in mind. And from this energy density function, we can obtain an expression of the stress as a function of parameters, the coarse grain k, lambda, and gamma, and the reference area A0, and the cell shape tensor M through its invariance in 2D, the determinant and the trace. And as announced, we find here among the parameters a coarse grain version of the cell junction tensions that are of interest. More recently, we have been working on extending this model to the case of collective cell migration. And what is missing in the previous description is, taking into account the polarity field of migrating cells. Indeed, each migrating cell has a front and a rear and defines a local polarity. And this local cell scale polarity can also be coarse grain in order to define a tissue scale polarity field. So what I present here very briefly and very schematically is a combination of our previous work on an hydrodynamic description of the tissue using a cell-shaped tensor and what we need in order to model, in addition, collective cell motility. So the assumptions that we make are actually fairly general. We use linear irreversible thermodynamics, which Jean-François described at length last year in his lectures on active gel models. We assume that total stress can be decomposed between what we just saw coming from the cell vertex model, a viscous term and an active term. And we consider a compressible tissue in 2D. The governing equation comes from transport. And here you will perhaps recognize the upper convective derivative that governs the transport of this tensor M. We use force balance. And next, we need an evolution equation for polarity. And here I give what perhaps could be the simplest possible example, where the angle theta, which determines the orientation of polarity, evolves in time according to the vorticity in the tissue, to local diffusion, and to a relaxation term, where this theta relaxes towards the direction given by the velocity field of the tissue on a time scale tau. I will not go into details, but will simply give you one example of a numerical simulation of this model, where, in fact, for simplicity, we forget about the cell vertex model part, consider only viscous and active stresses, have an expression of external forces, so traction forces, that is pretty standard today, which can be decomposed between a friction term here, opposite to the velocity, and an active propulsive term here, which is proportional to the polarity field. And with these ingredients, above the threshold values of the active parameters of the system, we find indeed an instability. So the homogeneous trivial solution to this set of equations becomes unstable to collective rotation. And as you can see, all fields rotate since they are all linked with each other. So this is the velocity, this is the polarity, and here you have the tension field on the bottom right, and to the left, the trace of the viscous term. We used parameter values that are taken from the literature and managed to find a reasonable agreement with all the measurements that had been made experimentally. So this is work in progress. And we are currently working on trying to refine assumption and in particular trying to see what is the right way to couple the polarity field to the other mechanical ingredient in the equations. So with this I will conclude. So the main message here is that we now have access to absolute measurements of the stress field in in vitro salmonella layers given the measurement of traction force data. All the examples I have given you here were performed based on individual snapshots on one image, and the movies that you saw were made by putting together these sequences of individual snapshots. Since then, but I have no time to go into this today, we have also implemented a Kalman filter with the same purpose of inferring stresses from traction forces, but this time taking advantage of the correlation between successive images and therefore dealing directly with full movies and not individual images. An advantage of this is that we do not need a prior in this case, so the Kalman filtering works without priors, which removes one of the hypotheses that we made. And a nice feature is that the inference performed with Kalman inversion gave results consistent with the inference that we had before with Bayesian inversion. And for the future, well, the first point I would like to emphasize is that since we now have access to stress patterns, both spatial and spatiotemporal, well, we will also need to compare these experimental stress patterns with predictions of models, because all models of the mechanics of tissue have a stress function, and therefore has predictions concerning stress. A possible extension of the method is to go back to cells. So, in fact, Bayesian inversion and Kalman inversion ignore completely the cells and the boundaries between cells, but and they give the special field of the tissue considered as a continuum, as a continuous medium. But if we know where the cells are, then from the given of the full stress patterns, it's easy to compute the stress in a cell, okay, by restricting the domain of interest to that particular cell, which is certainly an important piece of information. So we have, in principle, a method to infer cell-cell forces within a tissue. And so we have, as you have seen already, started a little bit with this, the combination of stress estimates with kinematic measurements, such as the elongation tensor, allows to study tissue rheology directly from this type of experimental data, and therefore provides an inverse approach to tissue rheology. And with this, I will close, and I thank you for your attention.